Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
There, thank you. So hello, my name is Dr. James Cummings. I'm assistant faculty in the Division of Emerging Media Studies. I also serve as co-director of the Communication Research Center, which helps put on the Communication Research Colloquium Series. So this is our very first colloquium talk of the semester, of the entire academic year, it turns out. And joining us today to kick off the semester is Dr. Lindsay Decker from the Department of Film and Television. This is where I do a bit of reading because my memory is limited here. Dr. Decker's, do you ever have this issue?
Sometimes. You'd be surprised.
I totally script my title and last name myself all the time. Dr. Decker's research and teaching interests include British cinema, international horror, genre studies, national and transnational cinema studies, post-colonial African and Indian cinemas, global new wave cinemas, and film culture. Today she'll be giving us a talk entitled Hybrid Horrors, Transnationalism, Film Culture, and British Horror Cinema of the 2000s. One might consider her an expert of sorts in the field of horror cinema, with work published in the journals Transnational Cinemas and Horror Studies. She also co-authored the Film and Horror Entry in the Oxford Research Encyclopedia of Communication for that topic. We're very excited to have her today, not only to hear about her research in particular, but to set a high bar and kickstart the academic year for the colloquium series. So if you all would, please join me in welcoming Dr. Decker.
All right. Hello, everyone. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Good. Good, good. To project. Thank you all for coming to my talk today. Thank you to the CRC for having me here to kick off their Communication Research Colloquium Series this semester. Thank you to Professor Cummings for just not at all any pressure with that intro, right? No pressure? Okay. So today I'm going to talk to you a bit about my book project, which is Hybrid Horrors, Transnationalism, Film Culture, and British Horror Cinema of the 2000s. Just so you know a little bit about where I'm at with this, this is my book project emerging from my dissertation. It's currently at two different presses, so fingers crossed. If I have time today, I'm also gonna talk a little bit about my future research, if we have time, but that's kind of an iffy thing. We'll see how it goes. So the title of my project is a pretty straightforward description of its focus. I'm looking at hybrid horrors, horror films that possess something called genre hybridity, meaning that they're not just straight horror, but possess characteristics of more than one genre or subgenre. So for example, some of the films that I examine are horror comedies. This is a GIF or JIF from Shaun of the Dead, which is a British horror film. You can see horror, bloody handprints, comedy, slipping in the blood. Comedy, talking about which kind of album you're going to throw at a zombie, throwing out the Batman soundtrack, and horror, zombies coming at you, wanting your brains. So genre hybridity. The kind of genre hybridity that I'm most fascinated by combines genres associated with different national cinemas and movements. So this means that films that combine particular formal and narrative tropes drawn from specific foreign genres with those from more traditional domestic genres. And I call it transnational genre hybridity. This is my term that I have come up with. So when you all, maybe if you ever write a dissertation, have to come up with a term, it's a pretty common practice. This is mine. So the term transnational is used to mean a lot of different things. It's been used to denote the ways in which production, distribution, exhibition, and reception of films are imbricated within a globalized economy that's often coded as American. It's also been used to categorize post-colonial, diasporic, and non-Western cinemas. So we have American and European cinema, and then we have transnational cinema, which is problematic. And And it's also been used to describe films that tell stories about cultural and geographic border crossing. Additionally, as transnational cinema scholar Deborah Shaw has pointed out, transnational has sometimes been used as a catch-all, rendering the term inadequate to face the very real complexities of categorizing different films and film practices. However, I use it here in a pretty straightforwardly descriptive way to refer to the film's generic hybridity as it is positioned with regard to nation. So I'm using the term in a different way than it's typically used, because folks don't usually talk about formal or narrative structure in terms of the transnational. And the sort of central argument of my project is that filmmakers can use transnational genre hybridity as a strategy to give their films an added layer of meaning, of commentary that contributes to debates within film culture. These debates might be about the national cinema that they're working in, they might be about the genre they're working in, or if they are a well-known director, might be about their overall films or their own style as a director. This argument goes against current thought about genre hybridity in films made after 1980, where genre hybridity is written off in film studies as simple postmodern intertextuality. Postmodern intertextuality just means after the 1980s, for some reason, everyone likes paying homage to everything else. Think of the movie Scream if you're a horror fan. If you're not, go watch the movie Scream. It's really good. So I make this argument because this is exactly what happened with British horror. And in my book, I show how embracing transnationalism helped kickstart and sustain the British horror resurgence, which started in 2002, by allowing filmmakers to contribute through their filmmaking to the conversation around horror genre in middlebrow British film culture. Before we get to the films, though, it's a lovely slide of 28 Days Later. Should be a blank slide. Pretend it's blank. Before we get to the films, though, we need to talk in a little more detail about middlebrow British film culture. Middlebrow British film culture and the film industry in the UK are very intertwined. So you have people writing for publications like Sight and Sound, or The Guardian, or The Independent. You have people doing film journalism. You have film academics who are all contributing to a conversation about British film. But it's not quite the same as when people do it in America, because a lot of those people also work in the British film industry, or they work on panels that the government is running to talk about the state of the British film industry. So historically, there's been a lot of overlap there. So they're helping to sustain the industry and shape governmental and cultural conversations about the industry. Very intertwined. Traditionally, British film culture has emphasized the cultural importance of taste, aesthetics, and auteurism, as well as espousing a general suspicion about the potential value of genre cinema and the potential for Americanization. That term is going to come up a lot in my talk. The Brits don't want to be like America. They are afraid of becoming like America. They don't want it. So the conversation around the horror genre in middlebrow British film culture was pretty dismal in 2002. Horror had long been considered to be nearly the lowest of low culture objects, something only enjoyed by sociopaths, and something capable of causing children to murder each other in copycat killings. These are actually the two most common things said about horror in British film culture before the 2000s. So British cinema is also, in the beginning of the 2000s, right in the middle of an ongoing identity crisis. Folks within film culture were constantly asking, but what is British cinema? And they were quibbling with each other over whether or not particular new films could be considered British or not. So there's this huge focus on identity. At the same time, they were also seeking global validation for films that they deemed appropriately British. So things that were talking about the heritage of Britain and the wonderful former empire of Britain that were very pro-Britain. This vacillation was caused in part by the insecurity of the British film industry itself, the responsibility for government interaction with the industry, and most importantly, industry funding, passed during these decades from the Minister of Arts on the Privy Council to the Department for National Heritage, to the Department for Culture, Media, and Sport, to the UK Film Council, before finally ending up at the British Film Institute. Five different organizations across the years figuring out who's going to get what money and when and whether anyone should get money at all. And this meant that the government's funding of the industry was constantly in flux and under threat, which made it difficult for the British industry to compete domestically and abroad, a reality which was reinforced by the continued dominance of American films at the British box office. So, the British horror resurgence that started in 2002 and produced a decade of successful British horror films made quite a splash in the midst of all these conversations going on in middlebrow British film culture. The splash was all the more impressive because British horror had long been all but dead. I know, it's a bad pun, I apologize. But between the late 1970s and 2001, there were less than 10 British horror films, less than 10 that had a theatrical release in the UK. So in a little over 20 years, less than 10 films exhibited, and only slightly more films were actually made during that time. It is a very just minuscule number of films. So when I say dead, I really mean nearly dead. And yet, starting in 2002, this output exploded, starting with Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later, which is the film that started the fast zombie trend, for those of you who keep up with zombie trends. Hundreds of films were being produced each year between 2002 and 2012, and there were generally 10 to 15 films being released theatrically per year. So you take the previous 20 years, and then it's just every year. What happened in those previous 20 years happens just in 1 year. Thus, what journalists and scholars have dubbed the resurgence, I feel like they could have picked a better word for this. They could have called it the resurrection or the rising, but unfortunately, I was actually in college myself, not in Britain, so I was not a consultable expert, which I will forever regret. So the most critically and financially successful films of the British horror resurgence after 28 Days Later include titles like Shaun of the Dead, Eden Lake, Attack the Block, and The Woman in Black, which is the one starring Harry Potter star Daniel Radcliffe. Just in case. We have some Radcliffe fans here, maybe. So these were the horror films that were most talked about within middlebrow British film culture. Unlike other horror, this particular set of films were often framed as having the ability to save the industry by taking on Hollywood, constituting a better quality horror film and potentially out-competing Hollywood horror at the domestic box office and the international box office. These were all also films that generically transgressed the boundaries of British national cinema, engaging in transnational genre hybridity. And I argue that this was no mere coincidence, that reframing British and foreign genres in the way of transnational genre hybridity allows these films to respond to and participate in ongoing discourses around Americanization within film culture, which had the effect of positioning these films as distinctly British, which again was very important for British film culture at this time because of their identity crisis. So in essence, I'm arguing that the British horror resurgence was possible because of British horror directors' use of transnational genre hybridity. To illustrate this idea and help make it clearer, I want to look at a concrete example of transnational genre hybridity. First, we will see how it manifests in a film via narrative and formal elements. Then we will talk about what sort of commentary the film is making. And then we will loop back to this broader argument that plays out throughout my project. We'll loop back. So, Eden Lake, James Watkins' 2008 hoodie horror film. The film follows Steve, played by Michael Fassbender, and Jenny, played by Kelly Riley, an urban, middle-class couple, as they travel into the English countryside for a romantic weekend vacation, only to be terrorized by local hoodies. Spoiler alert, neither of them makes it out alive. I have to give you that spoiler in order for anything else I say to make sense, so I do apologize, try to keep things spoiler-free. Couldn't avoid it. So if you aren't British, you might be asking yourself, what is a hoodie? Is it a piece of clothing? No. In the early 2000s, the UK experienced a moral panic around young working-class teens referred to as hoodies because of their preference for athleisure wear, hooded sweatshirts in particular. At this time, there was a perceived uptick in street crime and mall crime perpetrated by teens, but this was really more of a rise of the visibility of this kind of crime than an actual crime wave, as crime rates among teens were actually declining and had been in decline for years. Part of this rise in visibility was due to the teens themselves and the confluence of the spread of the internet, access to cell phones, and the popularity of all things of viral Jackass-style videos. For those of you who don't know what Jackass is, I'm very happy for you, but it's an MTV stunt and prank show that aired in the early 2000s. I see some of you are nodding. Led by Johnny Knoxville, where the people on the show would perform violent stunts on themselves or others, often involving graphic bodily injury or risk of such injury. In the case of one of the cast members, Bam Margera, in many of his segments on the show, he was filmed sneaking up on his sleeping father and then just slapping him, just wildly punching him. And the most visible crime perpetrated by these British hoodie teens was something called happy slapping, the practice of inflicting unmotivated violence on a randomly chosen person, usually an adult stranger, in public, and recording it with cell phones to share with friends and on the internet. So you can probably see the connection there. So, this is a story that came out in The Guardian in 2005 at the beginning of the panic really taking hold in the nation. And you might notice a couple of interesting words and phrases in this story. How a top can turn a teen into a hoodlum. Top is in clothes. Street rats. The hoodie teens are referred to as street rats, which I don't think is an Aladdin callback, but it would be amazing if it was. Disrespectful youths. They're talked about as happy-slapping, binge-drinking, hoodie-wearing, feral yobs. For those of you who are not super familiar with British culture, yob is basically a racialized slur that's kind of akin to white trash in the United States, but is not fit for print in a place like The Guardian. It is a little more of a slur. It's really surprising to see it there. But they are talked about as swearing and spitting their way across the country this week. So this is sort of helping provide an illustration, I hope, of how people thought about these hoodie teens. Mostly the emblematic image of a hoodie is a working class teen boy in a hooded sweatshirt. So there's definitely a gendered component as well as a class component to the hoodie. This is a very famous image in Britain of a young hoodie, Ryan Florence, making a gun sign at David Cameron, who was the then leader of the Conservative Party in the UK. He would go on to be elected to be Prime Minister of the UK. And he was visiting a council estate, public housing near Manchester, when this photo was taken. And this has sort of become like the iconic image of the hoodie in Britain. Looking at it, I'm sure you can just make some assumptions, probably, about Ryan Florence. So hoodies, though, are not just seen as part of one kind of environment. They're seen as a pervasive problem in urban areas, suburban areas, and also rural areas. This is a still from the hoodie horror film Attack the Block from Joe Cornish in 2011. Some of you might recognize John Boyega in the center. The representation of British hoodies in Britain encompasses a wide variety of racial and ethnic backgrounds. So even though the sort of most iconic image is of a white young man, things are a little more complicated than that. Other threads of discourse, they're more often coded as a multiracial group. But as in the United States, the white folks who are coded into the hoodie group are seen as racialized. So that is to say, made somehow less white through their association with fashion and music, thought to belong in some way to people of color, Black British folks in particular, in this instance. The threat of Americanization was a key part of the backlash against hoodie-wearing teens. Early in the panic, hoodie teen culture was linked to the import of dangerous American gangster rap. The rap itself, as well as the athleisure wear look and the purported violence that goes along with it. The hoodie got recoded from a fairly benign garment into a threatening top that one could wear because it hides you from CCTV cameras, so you can't be seen. You can commit your crimes in relative anonymity. So as with other moral panics historically, the hoodie panic had a lot more to do with white middle class fears about foreignness and racialized others than with the real people in the demonized group. So the moral panic turned the figure of the hoodie into what theorist Stanley Cohen calls a folk devil, a visible reminder of what we should not be, which in turn prompts experts and politicians to lead a moral crusade to diagnose and treat the problem in order to save people from succumbing to the threat. During times of moral panic, these folk devils bear the weight of all of our collective social anxieties and also bear the brunt of the full wrath of society's indignation. In the 2010 UK national political campaign, it was essentially the Conservative Party's moral crusade against hoodies, and the issues thought to have given rise to hoodies, including the supposed increase in antisocial behaviors and the breakdown of the heteronormative nuclear family. They were very upset about that, thought that it led to hoodies. So, a quick note, because I get this question a lot. We are all currently in the United States. The United States definitely has some discourses going on around young men of color who wear hoods, right? Actually, that could be taken many ways. I'm talking in specific detail about young men of color. So Trayvon Martin and his murder ignited a huge conversation in the United States about young men of color and what they're wearing. This is not the same thing. There's a sort of impulse to culturally map our problems onto the British hoodie panic. I assure you they are separate problems, in part because race in Britain has a lot to do with Britain being a former colonial power and having post-colonial immigrants coming into their country, whereas in our country, I think it's I'm speaking off the cuff, but it's pretty unarguable that a lot of our race relations are based around slavery. So different race relations in the countries, and also these hoodies are very much classed in a particular way, and class reads in a different way in Britain. I'm gonna take a drink of water. Okay. So, getting back to the film. This moral panic over hoodie teens led to a hoodie film cycle. I'm using the term cycle here as theorized by Amanda Ann Klein as a set of films with coherent semantics but without a coherent syntax. For those of you who have not just covered that in FT 250, basically that means that a cycle of films will share a set of iconography, settings, character types, and or plot points, but they won't necessarily share a coherent ideology or even primary genre. The hoodie cycle produced films in a number of disparate genres, including teen films, social realist dramas, comedies, crime thrillers and dramas, as with Michael Caine starring in Harry Brown, and also horror films. Even hoodie horror itself is not confined to a single subgenre, but includes home invasion narratives, the slasher, backwoods horror, which we'll get to in a minute, the gothic, sci-fi and horror. Highly recommend this film if you haven't seen it. So good. And also other films that fit less easily into existing subgenres, such as the action horror film Tower Block. Don't get a lot of action horror. This is some good action horror. So, what makes these films cohere as a cycle then, despite their disparate genre classifications, ideologies, basic narratives, is the semantic resonances between the films with the hoodie cycle. This means the figure of the hoodie itself. If it has a hoodie in it, it is likely part of the hoodie film cycle. Plots that revolve around working class teens and acts of violence committed by or against them. Very key to the hoodie film cycle. And settings in working class spaces, whether urban, suburban, or rural. And finally, oh no, that's it. Time is also a factor. Film cycles tend to burst onto the scene and then fade away again after 3 to 5 years of heavy production. This is because film cycles are often tapping into the timeliness of a specific cultural anxiety or concern. These films scratch a particular itch for viewers, but not in a long-term way, like the romantic comedy, for example. Because these films are interested in capturing a fickle audience's fleeting interest in a subject, film cycles are like small, detailed snapshots of a culture at a single moment in time. The hoodie film cycle started in 2006. The production cycle became fairly saturated between 2008 and 2012, and then the cycle faded away, with just one hoodie film being produced in 2013 and one other in 2015, and so far as I can tell, none since then. So hopefully you can see now how hoodie horror is a distinctly British domestic genre. Now, this is one piece of the puzzle that I'm interested in, how genre hybridity can combine foreign and domestic film traditions. For Eden Lake, the domestic genre would be hoodie horror. The protagonists are terrorized by hoodies, who we can see in silhouette on the film's poster. You look here, silhouette, some hoodies. Next, I want to look at the foreign genre that Eden Lake taps into, which is American backwoods horror. So, backwoods horror films generally follow several urban dwellers as they travel into the countryside to temporarily escape city life, only to run into rural peoples. So we have examples here, Texas Chainsaw, The Hills Have Eyes, classic examples of backwoods horror. So typical plot cues. City dwellers travel to a rural area. They run into rural peoples, sometimes inbred and often dirty and mentally unstable, who terrorize them in psychologically disturbing and usually graphic ways. Usually the city dwellers stop at an outpost of civilization, like a gas station, where the carnage to come is foreshadowed. Later, after a confrontation with the locals, they return to this outpost for help, only to realize that it is either populated and run by the rural maniacs they are attempting to escape from, or is about to be overrun by them. This loss of hope and the failure of civilized authority often leads protagonists to give up and quote unquote go native. That's the phrasing that people use around it. I'm not super happy with the phrasing, but that's how people talk about it, so we'll continue with that phrasing. But they go native by adopting the violence of the rural folks and turning it against them, sometimes successfully, sometimes less successfully. So, also this is a still from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the chainsaw dance scene. It's a great scene. So, the fear in these films arises in part because the city dwellers are not familiar with the rural environment. They don't have mastery over the space, despite the fact that these middle-class characters often assume that they do have mastery. This assumption comes in part because of the stereotype of simplistic country life, which positions rural areas in life as somehow simplistic in contrast to the sophistication of city living. The fear also comes from the threat of physical degradation. So horror films in the 1970s, in reaction to very sexual, very violent European films in the 60s, have a reaction in the horror films, and they're like, how sexual and how violent can we get? How far can we push the limits of these things? So for example, in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the threat isn't simply that Leatherface or someone in his family is going to murder you, it's that they could carve you up little by little, keeping you alive to preserve your body while they feast on the parts that they've already taken off. So it's a threat of being turned from a civilized human into literal meat, like a literal animal to be consumed. So beyond the visceral threat in the diegesis, though, American backwoods horror films tap into broader cultural fears. Now I'm talking primarily about the 1970s films, not the 2000s films. That's a whole different set of cultural concerns. But backwoods horror films depict the conflict between a privileged middle class who invades and uses for leisure the home space of a population that has little hope of economic mobility, and they're invested in showing these antagonists as mentally, physically, or sexually deviant from middle class norms in an attempt to justify that population's economic, geographic, and social marginalization. And in doing so, they're reinforcing American notions of meritocracy, and they're soothing middle class fears during the rough economic times of the 1970s. Horror and cultural rhetoric scholar Kendall Phillips has argued that Texas Chainsaw embodies the pervasive feeling in the 1970s that the American dream had died, and that the people knew that it was ending, and that behind the ending of the American dream lay the true face of humanity, which was one of violence and barbarism. And I would extend that argument to other backwoods horror films of the 70s as well, films presenting rural America as a place failed by both the capitalist economy and the government, filled with isolated people whose speedy and intense falling away from civilization reveals a profound anxiety about economic precarity, the instability of class boundaries, and fears of what base desires and behaviors will come out once the civilizing influence of urban spaces and capital fall away. So, how does this relate to genre hybridity, you might be asking? Well, Eden Lake draws heavily on the plot structure common to American backwoods horror films. The urban middle class protagonists, Steve and Jenny, venture into the countryside. They stop at a bar in a small town, the last outpost of civilization. Later in the woods, Steve and Jenny are terrorized by locals whose violence becomes increasingly barbaric. Jenny goes native and adopts the violence of the locals and murders two of them. She is able to escape back to the small town, the outpost of civilization, but once there she finds that this outpost is not civilized, that indeed it is comprised by the very locals who have been torturing her and Steve, her fiancé. All these plot details mark Eden Lake as a backwoods horror film. But at the same time, it is clearly a hoodie film, fitting into the British hoodie film cycle. Indeed, from the beginning of the film, it sets itself out as interested in the problem of hoodies. Jenny is a primary school teacher. The film starts with her leading her class of children in song, in this idyllic, beautiful, middle-class urban space. And then Steve picks her up for their romantic vacation. On the drive, there is a radio segment that, in the interest of time, I'm going to cut. But basically, on the drive in to the rural area, there's a radio program that's on in the background, and they are talking about the goodness of the idea of fining parents for their children's misbehavior. So you have some posh London experts saying, Well, clearly what we need to do is find these parents because they're not controlling their children. And then you have several women coming on the radio who have working class northern accents talking about how their children find it hilarious that their parents get fined when they skip school and how it's not at all a thing that prevents children from becoming delinquent. Not at all. So, even from the start of the film, Eden Lake, let's skip these slides, marks itself out with its concern for hoodies and fitting itself into the hoodie cycle and moral panic. What's actually being talked about here, finding parents who can't control their delinquent children, is important because of how it fits into that genre. So, reframing the backwoods horror film allows Eden Lake to use and indigenize the subgenre's pre-existing narrative structure. By indigenize, I mean that the film engages in the subgenre's in a political project that, while broadly similar to the project of the 1970s American backwoods horror film, is ultimately nationally and historically specific to Britain as well as being cycle-specific. Revealing what the film considers to be the dirty underbelly of British society by implicating rural working class families in the violence inflicted by hoodies, and positioning that violence as an integral, infectious part of working class spaces, and a number of subtle but key changes make this shift possible. So, while in the backwoods horror film, antagonists are often marked out as such by physical deformity or the appearance of below average intelligence, the physical indicators of monstrosity for the teens of Eden Lake are primarily their age, because they're teens, hoodie teens, accents that mark them out as working class and northern, and hoodie associated behaviors such as wearing hooded sweatshirts, listening to rap music on the beach, and using their cell phones to record violent incidents. These differences also manifest in the representation of rural communities more broadly in this film. So while the rural families in backwoods horror films often subvert traditional gender norms, so Leatherface takes over the domestic duties, takes on a more feminine appearance in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the families in Eden Lake conform really strictly to traditional gender norms. The women are not in charge of any decisions, and they are actually either only sex objects or caretakers. Those are the only two roles they have in the film. It's made particularly clear in the final scene. All the women are standing and hovering around Jenny, telling her that she is safe because there are big, ugly men about who will protect her. They can't call 911. They can't call an ambulance or the police. Well, I guess they wouldn't call 911 anyway because it's Britain. Sorry about that. They instead ask one of the fathers to do it, and he refuses, patronizingly telling Jenny, "You're safe here, love," mere minutes before he murders her in the bathroom. Mere minutes. So it's not just the portrayal of the hoodies and their working class parents that shows how Eden Lake indigenizes the backwoods horror formula, but also the portrayal of the rural space inhabited by the working class community and their relationship to that space. So basically, this is the beautiful quarry space that our middle-class couple, Jenny and Steve and Aiden Lake, go into. They invade this area. In backwoods horror films, the space that's being invaded is a home space. So in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the teens invade Leatherface and his family's home. They invade their business. It's their home space. It's their workspace. It's not a space of leisure. So, in Eden Lake, the class conflict plays out in a space of leisure that's used by both protagonist and antagonist. Slapton Quarry is a space of leisure in transition. It used to be a quarry that would have been used for mining. It becomes a lake that is public and can be used by anyone. And yet, in the film's present, this public space is in the middle of transitioning to a private living space, not for the working class community, but for a new gated community for upper class folks. So even though the hoodies win in the end, ultimately they do not win in the end because their leisure space is going to be taken over by an elite gated community. The Coming of the Gated Community shows that the only way to remain safe from hoodies and their parents is to actually fence oneself off from them. So this new upper class community, it's taking possession of the space over which hoodies feel mastery, reducing the space where they can go, and reducing or even eliminating their feelings of mastery over spaces within their community. Gated communities proliferated in the UK once the hoodie panic started because they were seen as protecting upper class folks from hoodie crime, despite the fact that hoodie crime was not on the rise. And so this film perpetuates a reactionary discourse within the hoodie panic that echoes and amplifies former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's infamous claim that there is no such thing as society. The hoodies and the parents in the film visualize the breakdown of society from discarding middle-class norms to not acknowledging the authority of social institutions like law enforcement to literally breaking down the bodies of the middle-class couple who ventures into their working-class space. Both Steve and Jenny also embody this breakdown in the ways that their behavior becomes increasingly more like the hoodies and parents the longer they remain in this space. There may be, as Steve tries to convince the hoodies, a big beach, but there isn't really room for either of them in it because the space is going to be taken over and taken from both of them. Walling it off to keep out the working classes and the middle classes and just kind of letting them fight it out. So, what I've tried to show through this example of Eden Lake is what transnational genre hybridity looks like in a film and how it manifests. But I'm not just arguing that transnational hybridity exists. I'm arguing that it is used as a deliberate strategy that filmmakers can engage with their own national cinema and film culture and discourses circulating about both the national and transnational within that industry and culture. So, if we think about Eden Lake, and we're thinking about how it's responding to discourses of Americanization and worries about whether British film is really British, I sort of did a thing with the prefix to the term transnational. And I thought, what are the different ways that the term trans can mean things and signify things? So the first kind of transnational that I talk about in my book is trans to change thoroughly. So it takes a foreign genre, changes it thoroughly to address a domestic issue, and that's what I'm talking about with Eden Lake. I also talk about trans as a cross or between two national cinemas or industries, which allows films to comment on their relationships. So we could think about Shaun of the Dead, uses British comedy. It draws from George Romero's zombie films, which are an American sort of thing unto themselves, commenting on the relationship between the two cinemas. And finally, the last way that I sort of talk about transnational genre hybridity in my book is the way that trans can mean beyond. So transnational genre hybridity can be used to position films as part of the global film industry or as part of a regional film industry. So I use that with The Woman in Black, which borrows from the global Gothic, including British Gothic and Japanese Gothic, and also the film Under the Skin, which is a British sci-fi horror movie that also borrows from European art cinema. And that's the book. By drawing intertextually on a variety of British film traditions, some more and some less exportable, the films I examine in this project position themselves in a lineage that confers both prestige and cultural capital, rescuing British horror from its low culture framing, using recognizably British film genres to reframe foreign horror subgenres, allows the films to respond to discourses about horror and anxiety over the Britishness of British cinema that circulated in British film culture at the time, attempting to legitimize the horror genre through association. And that is what I have for you today.
Any questions for Dr. Becker?
I have a question.
Hey, Noah.
I was wondering about the class, the clear class conflict that's going on. You mentioned at the beginning of your talk that Great Britain maybe has a hyper-awareness of class due to their understandable concern.
That we'll see.
My question is, if the horror genre is designed to have a message, and it's a negative message about the lower classes, are the upper classes viewing these films and getting the message, or are the lower class films watching these films, and if so, what's their reaction to this?
Yeah, so the other film that I look at in that particular chapter is Attack the Block, which delivers a positive message about hoodies and like how hoodies can become reintegrated into the national community. So it's not all bad messages. I just, when I was thinking about doing this talk, I was like, which example is most interesting to me right now? And I really wanted to talk about Texas Chainsaw a little bit, so that's why I picked it. But I think that one of the functions that horror can serve in the UK, it hasn't been thought of as a genre watched by upper class folks. It's been thought of more as a genre for the middle and working classes. But I think in terms of what it's doing with class discourses, you don't need to reinforce class discourses with elite folks, because in my admittedly Marxist understanding of class discourses, it's the middle class folks who come up with the class discourses by looking at what the elite folks are doing and saying, oh, that's what I need to do, that's what I need to aspire to. And then they're also the folks who are like impressing that upon other middle class folks, working class folks. So I think it's more of a middle class folk speaking to other middle class folk kind of situation. And certainly all the directors of the British films that I look at in my project are firmly middle class, if not Danny Boyle, millions of dollars kind of folks. Millions of euros, sorry.
I appreciate the negative.
Eventually pounds after Brexit.
I think you're right to take the negative view and to focus on the negative. I remember the news coverage at the time. It was very negative of political.
Yeah. I talk a lot more in the book about negative stereotyping of hoodies and the problematic racial and class politics and all that kind of stuff. So yeah. Oh, yes. And then we'll go over there.
Oh,
yeah.
I know this isn't necessarily about British cinema specifically, but how do you see that idea of sort of genre bending and transnationalism in horror that's been turned into franchise, and being specifically of like The Conjuring and its own cinematic universe?
Yeah. Yeah, well, so part of the reason that I decided to work on British cinema is because that's where I saw this happening, because the British industry is so concerned about what other people think about them, especially the United States, but they're like drawing on US genres. So in terms of American horror, the thing about US film is that really the only other nation that US film has been concerned about in the past like 15 years is China. So I wouldn't actually look to horror to find transnational genre hybridity in American film. I would actually look to things like the action film. So if you think about something like The Meg, there's a whole paper to be written about transnational genre hybridity in The Meg, which takes a sort of like classic 1950s American sci-fi genre tropes and then tries to add in Chinese sequences set in like it's a very nonsensical film. It's a good film though. I don't know. It's fine. I'm not saying you shouldn't like it. But yeah, I would look in other places, because I think it's more often a thing that you're going to see in non-American cinemas. But I think that's a very good question. Yeah. I'm gonna go over here and then Blake. Do you still have a question?
Well, I noticed that you talked about rap music and the hoodie.
Yeah.
What other sorts of music transnational sort of things in the background of these movies in terms of the British invasion and the United States, and how does that play into
it? Yeah, that's really interesting. So the there was sort of a cultural scandal around British rap music in the 2000s because of the influence of American gangster rap, right? Which is, if you actually look at what was going on musically, there wasn't an influence of American gangster rap, which is what makes it like doubly annoying that that's what people just assumed. They were like, oh, it's rap. All rap is the same. Yeah. So the kind of music that you primarily have in these films is very rap influenced. It's mostly a kind of music called UK garage, which is like a more rappy kind of house music. So that's the like primary kind of music. But I'd never thought about the music in terms of transnational influences. I might have to think more on that as I continue to revise, right? Yeah, never done revising. Blake.
So in terms of this concept of transnational genre hybridity,
where
would you situate something like The Ring or The Grudge, where it's an actual, just a remake of a foreign film with a different cultural context?
Yeah. Again, I think going back to your question earlier, I might situate that in terms of in the early 2000s, well, in the late 1990s, American horror films were not doing well after the success of Scream and the just barrage of sequels that came out after that. There wasn't a lot of interesting stuff going on, but there was a rise in international horror, especially Asian horror in the late 1990s, especially Japanese horror in the late 1990s. So I think, I don't know if I would frame that as transnational genre hybridity, because I'm not sure what American genre those remakes are tapping into. I would have to rewatch those films. I haven't seen them since I wrote chapter 4 3 years ago, where I talk about those films. But that's a really good question. Yeah. I got two. I'm going to go over here, but then I will come to Ruth, because Ruth,
So you talked about how they were borrowing from tropes within 1960s and 70s American horror films.
Yep.
And those films were mainly inspired by the kind of surge of news stories about like serial killers coming out. But there was really that's like more specifically Friday the 13th.
Yeah, that's really 80s films.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, like, why there was like a big wave of really high profile serial killer cases in England. Yeah. Like during this similar time period, why didn't they have the same kind of horror surge there?
They didn't have money. Mm-hmm. They didn't have money. Nobody wanted to give them money. So the way that the British film industry works is it's really hard to get money to make a film from people in Britain. Like British producers, there are not many of them. So if you want to make a film and you're a British filmmaker, the thing that you do is you turn to the government and you're like, British government, give me money. I need money for this film. And the way that they do that is you sketch out your pitch for your film and you submit it, but you also have to like fill out a cultural test for your film to see whether it is British enough. And like in the 1980s, there's just such a huge just hatred of horror in Britain because arguably it's sort of like a little bit more in the early 90s, but there was this case called the James Bulger case where two children who were very young took another child who was very young and they like took him out to some train tracks and they murdered him. And the British press just decided that those two kids had watched Child's Play, the horror film Child's Play, and they just latched onto that, even though it was fake news. They had not watched Child's Play, but they latched onto it, and they were like, oh, the horror is causing our children to murder other children. The horror is the worst thing. Only sociopaths like horror. So I think that's probably why you didn't get a lot of British serial killer films. Although Peeping Tom from the 1950s is a really great British serial killer film. Really good. Highly recommend. Yeah, it's really good. It's good times. Ruth?
I noticed that the two stars in Evil Link are Irish.
Yes.
Which is very interesting because like when the British horror genre last had its life, that was in the middle of when Irish people, especially in England, were kind of looked down upon because they were causing trouble. Is there like, is there Irish accent? No.
They have posh middle class, like posh London accents. It would have. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on with region in these films that's like really in the weeds. I didn't want to get into it today just because, like, non-British people, I'm not British, I have a hard time parsing the accent sometimes. It's like you listen to the accent, you're like, is that Manchester? or is that the Geordie accent? I can't tell which accent it is. So yeah, that's a really good question. I do go into more depth in the actual book about region. So yeah, it's a good question. Ooh, another question.
Sorry, I have another one. And this might not even sound like a question, but
more of a comment.
The question that you mentioned about how you need to petition to the British government about, you know, is this British enough? What was the indie horror film sort of thing? If there is an indie British horror, because that limitation of it has to be British might limit how many social fears you can express in these movies.
Yeah. So that's a really good question, but it is a question that I think we would only ask in America, because in the US we have the Hollywood studio system where there are studios to like fund films, and they don't really have a lot of that in Britain. Like, they don't have major studios that are connected to major conglomerates to give them lots of money. So mostly, like, the whole of the British film industry is indie filmmaking. Like, unless they do a co-production with a Hollywood studio, they're never gonna get the same amount of money that you could get for even like a typical indie production in the United States. So they're like working like uber low budget, which is partly why these films were so successful, because, you know, Danny Boyle made 20 Days Later for like $1 or $2 million, which is a preposterously low amount of money to make a film for. And it made so much money. He was just raking in the cash. Like, it's part of how Danny Boyle became the rich man that he is today. And then was like the mayor of Britain in the Olympics in 2012. So yeah, that's a really good question. But I think that in terms of indie, Brits are kind of all indie in the way that we think about it. Are we done? I think we're good. I think we're at 4:30.
May we welcome individuals to come up to you afterwards?
I welcome individuals to come up to me afterward. Yes, definitely. Thank you so much for coming.